From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic has upended our way of life like nothing else in recent memory. But it's certainly not the first infectious disease to plague our society. How governments respond to epidemics and pandemics are a test of their commitment to human rights and equality, as well as how they prioritize individual freedoms over collective safety. Today, as basic safety measures requiring public cooperation are victim to hyper-politicization, we take a look back at the history of American contagions, which is also the title of a new book by my guest, John Fabian Witt. He is a professor of law and history at Yale, where he serves as head of Davenport College. His earlier book, which won the Bancroft Prize, is Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. He joins me to discuss his new book, American Contagions, Epidemics, and the Law, from Smallpox to COVID-19. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this issue that we are experiencing, this new reality, this bizarre era in our life, is something that's new to most of us, but of course not new to American history. You start your history looking at smallpox. Why do you start there? And what are some of the similarities, just at least surface similarities, between that episode of American history when we, you know, where sort of when society was upended and this latest chapter?
Well, infection and the risk of infection turns out not to be anomalous in world history. I mean, I could say American history, but really it's human history. Viruses, bacteria, other infectious agents have been with us forever. And the law, as it's developed throughout the modern era, has had to respond to that. So we're in a situation that's new to us, but it wouldn't be novel to our ancestors, no matter where our ancestors came from. And so my book's about the way in which legal systems have tried to respond, and American law in particular, to this constant fact of human life.
So smallpox was a very, very serious disease. One big difference was that it seemed to spread fairly uniformly through our through societies, you know, unlike COVID-19, where, say, children are not as affected. There was a major vaccination campaign, such as the kind that we seem to be about to embark on. Let's talk about how government responded. You write in your book, you sort of split up the responses of government into two broad categories, the sanitationist state and the quarantinist state. What are those and how did they apply to the smallpox chapter of our history?
Well, every epidemic produces a moment of, well, of choice, of about values and how a legal system or a country is going to respond. And some states historically, and by states, I mean nation states in the international sense, although also states in our domestic sense, and some states have responded with authoritarian measures traditionally, restricting bodies and making the restriction of bodies and the limits on the autonomy of people the central mechanism for public health policy. And then other systems have responded by attending to environments, trying to improve the quality of life in particular environments. And smallpox was such a scourge of human social life for so long. And one of the reasons I spent time with smallpox is smallpox produces a set of, you know, mandatory vaccine policies across the United States, which existed up until the essential extermination of smallpox in the 1960s and early 70s. And those cases, legal cases brought around smallpox vaccinations, supply the legal background, the foundation for public health powers in the United States today.
You point out in your book that there is a broad view that disease drives change, but you take a different view, saying that it's really how we respond to disease, what the political responses to disease are that set policies that have repercussions. Well, what do those who, you know, claim that disease drives change, what is their justification for making that claim? I mean, there's certainly some indication. One could see the perspective that, for example, when settlers came to the United States. They brought with them disease that largely wiped out huge swaths of the indigenous population. And we've seen disease as big markers of change across history in different countries.
For sure. So one way to think about the rise of central features of the modern state, modern legal systems themselves, is as a response to the risk of contagion. The police power is the power to look after the welfare of the people, the salus populi, as an old Cicero quotation has it, the health of the people. And that's the supreme law in Cicero's account, and was in basic modern legal systems too. So the idea that infection or disease drives the basic structures of our society, that's been around forever. You gave a great example, terrible example, of the peopling, the repeopling, and the transformation of the Americas after 1492. The Black Death in medieval Europe, another classic example of the way in which states are reconstructed in response to a massive epidemic effect. But as you say, there's also the flip side. That is to say, viruses and infectious agents respond to the world that we produce. All you need to do is look at comparative COVID-19 epidemics, pandemics, look at the South Korea and compare it to the United States. And we see such different outcomes that we know that our state institutions, our legal institutions, our societies are also constructing the way the epidemic produces change.
Now, there's so much that a government can do that claims to still remain democratic, which is that the government can require certain things or encourage its population to do certain things, but you need cooperation. Countries like South Korea, countries like New Zealand seem to have found a way to create a culture of cooperation or engender a culture of cooperation that hasn't required as much authoritarianism, whereas the United States has almost, under Trump at least, thrown its hands up and given into the culture of individualism and not even tried to enact basic measures that could protect public safety while balancing individual freedoms. So the U.S. seems to, unfortunately, have put human safety and life at the bottom of the pile of priorities.
Well, one of the things I wanted to do in my book was describe a past in American history that wasn't a past of so-called rugged individualism that would explain why we're in the situation we're in today, but rather describe a past in which American states responded with robust powers, radically limiting the freedom and autonomy of individuals during epidemics, or just generally. I mean, the modern American city was built on the police powers that responded to things like cholera in the first half of the 19th century, the clearing of pigs from the streets, the ending of the rendering of horse carcasses in downtown Manhattan, the movement of burials outside of city limits. All these
things that we take for granted, right? I mean, we can't imagine now that those things could have even been tolerated, but the government had to make them happen.
Right. So we have a long history of democratically enacted, insofar as the U.S. was a democracy, the further we go back in time, democratically enacted regulations that substantially limited our freedom, but did so for a purpose of providing public health. And we've lost touch with that, maybe because we thought we defeated infectious diseases in the second half of the 20th century, maybe because partisanship has undone our ability to respond in rational ways to things like this pandemic.
There is, of course, always a danger of authoritarianism, and that's one of the reasons why the fear against restrictions is so widespread, because there's a small grain of truth that a government that tended toward authoritarianism could take advantage of an advent such as the COVID-19 pandemic to enact sweeping police powers. Have we had that sort of a chapter in American history?
Well, there have been all sorts of ugly moments in the use of the police power. And this is, and I'll list some, but just to observe at the outset, this is the terrible thing about grave powers. We might need them to respond to crisis moments. Think about, for example, the war power. One might need it And yet it's terribly dangerous. And it's much the same with the police power and its ability to respond to something like an epidemic. But just think, for example, of the terrible Tuskegee experiments in the middle of the 20th century, in which the police power to figure out how to stop syphilis turned into a set of experiments on Black men who were lied to and left untreated for decades.
The legacy of which is still present today and deep, justifiable skepticism toward the medical establishment.
Right, and we're now going to pay for it in the way in which many Americans have a skepticism around vaccines, because there are such terrible moments in our history. So that legacy is for sure still with us.
So let's hone in on that a little bit more, because the authoritarianism from governments has often not been applied equally. How has authoritarianism combined with discrimination, particularly racial discrimination or ethnic discrimination, produced disasters?
Well, when I looked at American history and tried to think about these two traditions we find in the world, quarantinism and its authoritarian controls of bodies on the one hand, and sanitationism, its liberal attentiveness to environments on the other, I concluded that America has a mixed legacy, a mixed tradition, in which we've got both of those traditions in our history. And in particular, vulnerable populations, people of color, sexual minorities, immigrants, have been the poor, have been the victims, the targets of quarantinist policies, while middle class and whites have oftentimes benefited from really successful sanitationist policies.
And actually, did we see a little piece of that in the early days of the pandemic in New York City, when we saw our shelter-in-place orders and masking being sort of policed in very different ways, depending upon whether it was in wealthy white neighborhoods or lower income Black neighborhoods?
Right, for sure. That was one of the threads that was running through the popular conversation, was that problem of discriminatory enforcement. And of course, there were lots of communities that thought they were the targets of discriminatory enforcement. We also saw the let's call it the new discrimination problem, although it's actually age old, in which poor communities, disproportionately communities of color, weren't able to stay at home and stop working. They were the right ones on the subway from Queens into Manhattan. And those neighborhoods in Queens early in the pandemic were just devastated by this pandemic. And that's kind of a new form of quarantinism, or a new way in which our basic social structures are participating in forms of de facto discrimination.
Right. The essential workers who tended to be brown and Black and immigrant and low income, and also have had the least protections. And now, of course, our Republican Party wants to protect corporations from lawsuits that might be based in health and safety issues. Let's talk about today. Your book compares smallpox to COVID-19. Of course, we are still very much in the early stages of this pandemic. But how do you view the hyper-politicization of some very basic means of protecting ourselves that simply require a little bit of collective thinking? It seems as though there's one party in this country that is jumping on this politicization bandwagon.
Well, sadly, I agree with that. I've often tried not to... I've tried to engage in conversation that's not just partisan, but right now the Republican Party seems to have been captured by a kind of fantasy about the past, an imagined history of individual freedom regardless of disease. And sadly, it's reached the U.S. Supreme Court. Just the night before Thanksgiving, a few weeks ago, as you and I talk here, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the public health officials' system of regulating religious gatherings in New York State, and that's now extending across the country. And the way in which a particular set of ideas about our past is now overruling the best public health advice we have is really disturbing. It's a really dangerous feature of our present and our future.
So we seem to be moving in a slightly better chapter where science and liberal values might be taking over from what we've seen over the past year. But what would you, looking at American history, see as the best way forward to tackle the COVID-19 crisis when it comes to trying to balance all of these kind of competing pressures? Obviously, there's a need to protect individual freedoms. Obviously, there's a need to protect all of our life and safety through collective action. There does need to be some measure of government enforcement, but government enforcement can be abusive when applied discriminatorily. So where do you land in all of this for our current chapter?
Well, I like the approach adopted in a 1905 U.S. Supreme Court case called Jacobs against Massachusetts. And it was a smallpox vaccination case. You and I started talking about smallpox at the outset of this conversation. And there, what Justice John Marshall Harlan says, writing for a majority of the justices, is he says that real liberty is not just a freedom from interference from others. It's a freedom that reflects the fact that others affect us too. And it's up to our democracies to work out how to make flourishing happen. And that's the real liberty that Harlan had in mind. Now, Harlan isn't naive. He understands that there can be abuses. And so he observes that the Supreme Court, the court system generally, will be there to check especially cruel or unusual uses of the public health power. He keeps the courts in the game, but he makes clear that the courts have a kind of supervisory role, and that our democratically elected officials in conjunction with public health experts, that's going to be the way we're going to have to resolve these crisis moments. There's simply just no other good way.
So civil liberties versus collective welfare, which is, as you put it, I'm wondering if you think that there is anything different about our COVID crisis, that applies to your analysis. One thing is the sanitationist state can only go so far, because for COVID-19, we know that transmission is person to person in a respiratory manner, that you can sanitize every surface you can think of, or the government can. But when people breathe on one another, that seems to be what passes the disease. And the other is that the other huge difference is that science has come a very long way since smallpox. We know so much more. We know how to know things much faster. The development of the vaccine has been lightning speed. It remains to be seen how it plays out over the next several months. But these sort of major differences just in the basic facts around COVID-19, is there anything that we need to think about?
Well, one thing is that the epidemic itself, it isn't necessarily an opportunity for sanitationist policies, but it's made salient, it's highlighted the ways in which our public health system needs to be more robust. Our system of healthcare delivery needs to radically expand the healthcare opportunities of the poor, the non-employed, of Americans generally. That's become super salient as a result of this pandemic. I'd also say that, during HIV/AIDS in the 80s and 90s, still today, of course, but one thing that HIV/AIDS did was make possible a new idea among public health authorities. The idea was that civil liberties and public health might not be at odds with one another. You needed the cooperation and the participation of the people in vulnerable populations in order to make public health policy work. And that idea is still enormously influential in public health circles today. What COVID-19 and new technologies have done is put that a little bit in question. Maybe there are new tracking technologies, some suggest, that would allow us not to induce the participation or cooperation of vulnerable populations. Maybe there are authoritarian mechanisms that could be put in place. And so that's a scary new moment for us after a couple decades of a kind of rapprochement between individual liberties and public health.
Let's talk about vaccines. That's a really critical part of the next chapter on COVID-19. Already, we are seeing that while the government has poured a lot of funding and political cachet on the development of a vaccine, getting the public to actually take the vaccine is a whole nother thing. And we have seen a rise in vaccine skepticism, perhaps because many of us don't remember how eradicated diseases that are now eradicated just devastated our communities. We take for granted that vaccines have worked, that enough people have taken them. And you mentioned that there was at one point a vaccine mandate. So where does the country lie now with respect to the law around vaccine? And what do you think needs to happen for us to end this chapter on the pandemic, assuming the vaccine is safe and easily, you know, and actually works?
Well, there are going to be two big legal questions, and neither one of them is really right before us. The first is, will we need or want vaccine mandates? And that question isn't before us because right now we don't have enough vaccine for the many tens of millions of people who would like the vaccine. So we haven't reached that mandate question, but it's easy to imagine we could be in a situation where to provide social safety for everybody, we'll need a higher percentage of people with the vaccine than we have. So that's one set of questions, will we need a vaccine mandate? The other questions are going to be about who owns the vaccines and who owns the intellectual property rights to the vaccines. And we're already starting to see controversy about those questions, especially as developing countries move to respond and try to manufacture vaccines for their own populations. So in a way, there are going to be those two sets of questions, mandate questions at the consumer side, and then intellectual property rights questions at the supply side. And there's a real chance for a new authoritarianism through the property rights of vaccine manufacturers, producers, drug companies on the other.
And why would the fight around property rights impact the accessibility of the vaccine?
Well, you could imagine would-be manufacturers, say in India, for example, who, if they could have the IP, if they could get breakthrough intellectual property rights, could produce mass amounts of vaccine. We might be able to increase our production capacity around the world with an expanded approach. Of course, the risk is that you undo the incentives that drove drug companies into the manufacturing business in the first place. There should be good solutions to this. I don't know that we're going to have a real crisis here, but this is a real thing that needs to be worked out.
And of course, we have a much more globalized world today than we did 100 years ago. Man, there's many more people that travel. It doesn't help if there's still a pandemic raging in one part of the world and we've largely eradicated it in the other part of the world. And there's also a question around vaccine requirements for travel. We'll certainly have to see how things play out there. Well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much for having me on, Sonali. It's been a real pleasure.
My guest has been John Fabian Witt. He's a professor of law and history at Yale, where he also serves as head of Davenport College. He's the author of the Bancroft Prize-winning Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. We've been discussing his latest book, American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.